Hi, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I'm joined today by Nick Gillespie. Hello, Nick.
Hi, good morning.
Catherine Mangu Ward.
Howdy.
And Peter Suderman is here to join us.
Good morning.
And Peter, I want to turn to you first because we're going to talk about the Senate's health care bill, which is currently muddling through. The Republicans have concocted their rejoinder to the House's bill and are trying to push it through. They can only lose two of their Republican ranks and still have it pass. And currently there are five holdouts. So is it likely that they're going to have a vote anytime soon? And is it likely that they're actually going to win it, Peter?
Right now, I think the answer is nobody knows, probably including Senate Republican leadership. There are currently five holdouts. One of them is Dean Heller from Nevada, who has basically said he doesn't like the way the Senate bill treats Medicaid. The Senate bill would roll back Obamacare's Medicaid expansion over a period of 3 years starting in 2021. It would convert it into a per capita block grant. That means that states would get money based on the number of individuals who are enrolled in the program rather than the traditional federal matching rate that they've been getting. And then it also, starting in 2025, further ratchets down the rate of inflation by which the Medicaid program can grow. So over the long term, if all of this went into effect, which I should say is definitely not something that you should count on, given sort of the number of years that Republicans have put in between now and these changes taking effect. But if they did go into effect, it would restrain Medicaid growth quite a bit more than even the House bill would over a number of years. And so that's Heller's objection. And then there's four Republican senators who are also objecting from the right. And that's Mike Lee, that's Rand Paul, it's Ted Cruz, and it's Ron Johnson. What those four basically have said is that this bill looks too much like Obamacare. And I think they have a point there, too. This bill really is a kind of lighter version of Obamacare. It's Obamacare, but less of it. And what it does is basically it keeps Obamacare's individual market subsidies in place for people buying insurance on the individual market. But starting in 2020, again, another kind of interesting delay, it ratchets back the top end of those subsidies from 400% of the poverty line. That's about $100,000 or a little less a year for a family of four, ratchets it down to 350% of the poverty line. That's maybe $86,000 a year for a family of four. It also keeps Obamacare's major regulations in play at the federal level. It does include some provisions that allow states to have more flexibility in terms of how they implement this, but it doesn't allow states to opt out of the pre-existing conditions rules like the House bill did. And so what those folks want is not entirely clear, but they basically want a bill that looks less like Obamacare. It's not really clear how they could get brought on. At the same time, you asked, are they going to vote soon? They are still talking as if there is going to be a vote sometime this week. That can't happen until there's a CBO score, which means that which is expected to come out in the next couple of days. But it's possible that they will rush ahead and we will see a vote before this week is out. I also think it is distinctly possible that despite, you know, McConnell and some of the other Senate Republican leaders saying, well, we're going to vote for this week, we're going to try and get there, they just won't, and that this will stretch on into July.
Hey, Peter, could you answer some questions that I've been asked lately, and I wasn't fully sure where they were, you know, what the exact answers were. But in terms of the Senate bill, and I guess even the House bill, people keep talking about this cuts Medicaid spending, but then Republicans say Medicaid spending goes up each year that the bill is in effect. And this is all apart from the question of whether or not Medicaid is worth saving. I know you've written about the really soft, if any, positive linkage between Medicaid and actual health outcomes. But I mean, is it true? Does this gut Medicaid, and isn't Medicaid in any case one of those programs that is just rife with all sorts of inefficiencies and wasted dollars?
So it depends on how you look at it. By one measure, Medicaid spending would keep, you know, what, just sort of on a flat dollar basis, if you're not thinking about enrollment, if you're not thinking about inflation, if you're not thinking about anything else, Medicaid spending would basically keep going up. And then starting in 2025, there would be a growth cap. What they would do is change the rate of inflation that Medicaid spending is tied to from medical inflation to general inflation. And we know that medical inflation rises much faster than general inflation. But that's assuming that that goes into effect. That's two presidential elections away from us at this point. So there's a lot of political uncertainty built into this bill. The other thing that it would do is that it would ratchet back the enhanced funding for the Medicaid expansion population that was included in Obamacare starting in 2021. And so states that are kind of counting on Medicaid money that have expanded Medicaid under Obamacare, and that's majority of states, but not all of them. I believe it is 19 states that have not. So it's slightly more have expanded than not. Those states that have expanded are counting on that money, and that money is in many ways an integral part of those state budgets. This is one of the reasons why the Supreme Court said a few years ago when they were ruling on Obamacare's mandate and on the Medicaid expansion that the Obama administration could not include a threat to cut off all Medicaid funding for states that did not expand, is because that would represent essentially the words that they used in the court ruling were a gun to the head of states, because Medicaid is so heavily tied into state budgets. And, you know, this is a sort of longstanding issue with Medicaid, is that apart from being a healthcare program, it has become so deeply embedded in the state budget situation because states have this incentive to keep expanding the program and keep spending more on it, since the federal government pays them every time they do that. And of course, money is fungible. And so, you know, in some ways this goes to the program, but it also just sort of helps keep state budgets afloat, and states have a hard time thinking about how to work without it.
Yeah, in every state in the country, I believe, it's either Medicaid spending or education spending is the single largest budget item. They're number one and two, depending on the state. But Medicaid is a crappy program, isn't it? I mean, because one of the things that I guess happens in a lot of these discussions, and we saw this with including some last minute regulations that had not gone into effect, midnight regulations passed by the Obama administration. But, you know, once something even gets announced, people are like, how we can never live without it. And you would think, you know, given the data on health outcomes in Medicaid, not necessarily people who are enrolled in Medicaid not doing better than people who are not enrolled in Medicaid of similar economic status, we should be working towards changing Medicaid. I mean, it's not good for the people it's ostensibly serving, and it's breaking every, you know, state budget basically that there is. I mean, do you think the Republicans should be more serious about saying, you know, we've got a lot of different issues here, but one of them is just that Medicaid, which is a federal program, you know, and that coaxes states into spending more money in bad ways. Like, we need to reform that and come up with a different way of doing that if we're going to subsidize states in giving health insurance or health coverage to poor people.
That's not even on the table, though, right? I mean, you are of course right that is the approach that ideally Congress and particularly congressional Republicans could and should be taking, but it's so far from the approach they're actually taking. It's in fact basically the same thing with higher education spending, with to the extent that the federal government subsidizes K-12. It's again the same, and it's not a coincidence that those are the two areas where the increasing costs of those goods in those sectors are so far above virtually every other industry or sector.
Peter, it's my understanding, and I could very easily be wrong on this, but it's my understanding that the Senate Republican bill would maintain the Obamacare legislation, which prohibits insurance companies from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions, but it does remove the individual mandate. I understand the philosophical argument against the individual mandate. Economically, is that a good idea?
No, every single state that has tried the combination of pre-existing conditions rules without an individual mandate has swiftly seen their individual health insurance market enter a death spiral, which is where prices go up because people only use insurance when they get sick. Insurance companies say, we can't make any money in this market. They drop out. Prices go up further, healthy people stay out of the market because prices are going up, and then insurance companies further drop out because they're only serving an extremely sick, extremely expensive to cover population. Washington State is one of the states where this happened. And so, in fact, this is something that we are likely to see at some point this week, possibly, in the very near future, is that Republicans say they're going to insert a continuous coverage provision into the law, which would basically keep people out of the market for 6 months if they let their coverage lapse. And what that is supposed to do is incentivize people to get coverage and to stay covered. I think that a provision like that is likely to be leaky and perhaps not terribly effective.
Because they're assuming that everyone is thinking 6 months ahead and rationally and also economically at the same time?
Which is totally true. That's
well,
how people
I don't know if they're thinking that if they're thinking that people are thinking economically and rationally and 6 months ahead, I think they're thinking that we need to have something in here that at bare minimum that the CBO will score that we can say is designed to incentivize people to get into this to maintain coverage. But of course, after having run against the individual mandate for 7 years, we can't have an actual individual mandate. So we'll have an individual mandate workaround. The House bill had one of these too. It was a 30% surcharge charged by insurers for people who had let their coverage lapse. And the House bill's individual mandate workaround was actually worse because what it did basically was it gave healthy people an incentive to stay out of the market and wait until they were sick to buy coverage.
I just want to interject here that every single time I hear the phrase death spiral, I think of what it means in figure skating, because it is actually a figure skating term. And you've seen this, even if you've only watched like 2 minutes of figure skating, where the dude spins around in the middle and he stretches the lady out parallel to the ice. And she's like, looks like she's going to scrape her head on the ice. And I always imagine like a couple of politicians doing that. Like, I just want you to imagine, Rand Paul, like, in a tutu skating along the ice with Obama spinning him around in the middle, just to make this whole debate better.
What a
better.
Far more
I
elegant
think that's
model.
The, that, is that a picture of Obamacare or of the Republican healthcare bill? Maybe it's the two bills dancing together.
I think it signifies that the two bills are really functionally part of the same dysfunctional dance.
I agree with you, Catherine, because, to the extent that, like, to bring it back to the kind of first principle that I think bothered a lot of people in the libertarian world was the individual mandate and the idea that the government could force you to engage in commercial activity or economic activity that you didn't want to, which goes beyond even regulating existing activity, which is already was expanded under the Commerce Clause during the Roosevelt FDR years. But it's, if the Republicans, they chose to oppose Obamacare mostly by saying that it was, it would gut Medicare and stuff like that. They didn't really take on the individual mandate strongly enough. I think the people who did that were really kind of outside the Republican Party. But it's, to the extent that you're constantly talking about universal coverage, you're going to talk about forcing people into the system somehow, as opposed to just expanding the supply so that, we don't need universal coverage for hamburgers and for shopping, for clothes and things like that. People can afford them because there's functioning markets. And Peter, what are the, one of the reasons for the individual mandate, if not the main one, is the idea that people with pre-existing conditions wouldn't be allowed in. So you have to, spread the risk over healthier, younger people, et cetera, who have no reason to buy insurance. What were the situations that allowed people to, or states to have high risk pools for people who couldn't get coverage on the markets, which is always small anyway? You know, like were some of those working? And I mean, you know, I guess I have two questions, like thinking about this stuff. And it's just it's nauseating listening to Republicans kind of dicker around the edges of stuff rather than actually speaking towards creating better healthcare policy. But did any of the high risk pools that states were using, were those effective in covering people with bad situations without totally distorting the healthcare market? And then is there any chance that any of this conversation is going to come to come to the fore again?
So again, it depends on who you ask and how you think of these programs. And I know that that's a little bit of a wishy-washy answer. But if you look at the state high-risk pools that existed before Obamacare was went into place, what you basically saw were programs that had somewhat high premiums. And so they could be expensive to get into. And people, liberals complained that they were consistently underfunded. And this is also something that we've even seen folks folks on the right, some of the Mercatus scholars say, yeah, these programs were underfunded for what they were trying to do. And so it was difficult to kind of keep them afloat. The idea behind them was basically that you buy out the sickest portion of the risk pool, and then the rest of the risk pool becomes affordable and basically, you know, sort of middle class normal people who don't have extreme health problems can get into it. And so the state kind of takes on some of the risk, you know, sort of slices off the really high end of the risk and then creates a more manageable, you know, sort of individual market underneath that. I think it's really instructive also to look at the temporary high risk pool program that was created under Obamacare. And when that program was, and that was created sort of as a bridge between when the law was passed in 2010 and when its major coverage provisions were supposed to go into effect a few years later, and are supposed to cover the really needy cases. And initially, the Congressional Budget Office assumed that that program would be wildly oversubscribed and therefore wouldn't be able to pay for everyone that needed to be in it or wanted to be in it. And what ended up happening is that it was wildly undersubscribed. In the end, at the very high end, only about 115,000 people ended up in that program. Those people, however, were very expensive and very sick. And we saw some states in which they were actually over budget while only having a very small number of people inside the program because the people who went in ended up being very sick. And so it just sort of lets you know how difficult these programs are to design and set up and run well, and how bad, our policymakers are at envisioning what the problems are and designing centralized systems to solve them.
Yeah, I just want to get a jab in here. I mean, this is so fucking retarded in terms of, like, you know, this is we're trying to extend 20th century or even 19th century entitlement spending into the 21st century. And it's like the demographics don't work, the economics don't work, and nobody will talk about just increasing the supply and the variety of healthcare. It's maddening, you know, and the Republicans, you know, who disappoint at almost every turn are just, I mean, they're driving off a cliff here because they did have an opportunity where they, you know, own the House, they own the Senate, and they own the White House. And to be talking like this, it's deeply disappointing because all they're doing is they're kicking the can off the road into the Grand Canyon. And then it's going to be somebody a little bit down the road in a few years who will have to pick it up and actually, you know, do something that makes sense.
This entire debate is also just a study in loss aversion on every level, right? So on the top level, we have the Republican-dominated Congress, which just doesn't want to lose their seats. And then on the level of the users of these markets and of the government-provided subsidies, we have people who, you know, these are new benefits. These are new benefits that people did not have a few years ago that every commentator is acting as if it's their God-given right. It's the status quo as it has always been, and to take it away will be an act of savagery. And I think, you know, it's true that it feels like that, right? To people who do have insurance provided through these new mechanisms, to say, okay, well, that's going away now, does feel like a blow. But from a larger perspective, you know, people were getting health insurance. The vast majority of people who currently have health insurance were getting health insurance through through a system before Obamacare. They will have health insurance again after Obamacare, should it be repealed. But it just, everyone is acting like it's so dire that any element of this be rolled back at all. And the same thing was true with Trump's budget, right? The idea that we would, you know, scale back spending on various agencies to, you know, 2009 levels was like, oh my God, the dark ages are upon us. And thinking of stuff like the discussion of whether breast pumps and lactation services will be covered. They were not covered before. The notion that, you know, people are walking around with signs saying Donald Trump wants working mothers to not be able to breastfeed, it's this incredibly kind of myopic view of what the situation was before and kind of what the moral weight of taking those changes away.
Catherine, there are a variety of organizations that are all lining up angry at the Republican bill and worried about it. The American Childhood Cancer Organization, and they all have similar concerns that as this transition happens, and they tend to be hyperbolic, but as this transition happens, people that are switching from one system to the other will be without health care and will die. So there's this presumed human toll of going from one system to the other. Is that overblown? Is that just something that has to happen as we get to a better system, or is it not an issue at all?
You know, this is something I actually learned from Reason's own Peter Suderman. So how lucky that he's here on the podcast is the assumed connection between having health insurance and getting health care, and even the assumed connection between having specific benefits mandated and the usage of those benefits is not nearly as obvious as you might think. The idea that we have some kind of different measured physical healthcare outcomes in a situation where there's actually just a bunch of politics layered on top is something that's, I think, it's not obvious, and that people who want to pull heartstrings don't hesitate to exploit that confusion.
And Nick, to go back to your point earlier, you've brought up expanding the supply a couple of times, and I assume that is a part of what you would like to see happen in healthcare reform. When you say expand the supply, do you mean more doctors and just introducing a market mechanism to do usual supply and demand for cost, or what exactly are you getting at when you say that?
It's a bunch of things. One is, you know, the idea of, you know, kind of nurse practitioners being allowed to do more. The medical delivery system is arguably, you know, the most regulated part of the American economy. Whether it's the American Medical Association or other interest groups, they keep a very tight lid on the number of doctors who are trained, what people in different places are able to do in terms of prescribing rights, in terms of seeing patients. There are prohibitions on various forms of telemedicine and where you can do, you know, various types of checkups. For God's sake, I don't know if it's every state, but if it isn't, it's like 49 out of 50 women have to go see a doctor to get a prescription in order to get birth control, which is even people like Bobby Jindal, the former governor of Louisiana, who was a staunch Catholic, said that birth control, oral contraceptive should be over the counter.
Right, because the women will overdose, Nick. They're delicious, yeah. Delicious birth control,
you know what?
Pills.
I worry about the young boys.
The number of times I've had to hold myself back from just swallowing a whole pack of those pills. It's tough, guys.
And, you know, and this
once
idea,
you pop,
though,
you
that
can't
you
stop.
You can't, but it's, you know, there's so many things that, you know, many states have certificate of need programs. So to expand various kinds of hospitals and treatment centers, you have to effectively get buy-in from your competitors through a state board or a local board that says, okay, yeah, you can expand or you can build this facility. There are so many ways in which healthcare is regulated in kind of the dumbest ways possible. And that's just actual healthcare. It's not even insurance. It's just like, what can you sell? What goods and services can you sell under what circumstances? And yeah, I would love to see that get wildly deregulated because most things, you know, most healthcare is not about, you know, end of life care. It's not about complicated surgeries and cancer. It's about very basic kind of things where it's like taking antibiotics, going to see a doctor or a healthcare, you know, professional. These are, it's not rocket science, and it should be a much freer and more open market as far as I'm concerned.
I think the big problem is, you know, that healthcare is so heavily tied up in government spending. It's about 50% of all healthcare spending in the United States is government spending somehow or another. And we've got one party that wants to just radically increase that. Once, you know, right now we are seeing a real shift towards more open support of single payer from the Democrats. And we've got another party that kind of wants to rejigger the way it's spent and maybe expand it a little more slowly. And there's no party, there's no sort of political movement towards a system that really attempts to unwind that system and try to make it make more sense. I mean, in addition to all of that government spending, you have all of these rules. Nick was talking about some of these. And we also now basically have four different major healthcare programs running in the United States. We've got the employer-sponsored insurance carve-out. We've got Medicare, Medicaid, and now we've got Obamacare or whatever the Senate, whatever the Republican bill ends up being, which looks a lot like Obamacare. And no one is really trying to unwind this system of fragmented, subsidized third-party payment that we have built up over the last 50 years and that is causing our healthcare system to just, really kind of, it's a huge drag on healthcare in the United States and on the economy, I think.
If I can pipe in for a second, you know, one of the ironic outcomes, and this goes back to a Bush-era regulation that enhanced, I guess it was the Medicare prescription drug program, which also should be gotten rid of. The idea of giving free or heavily subsidized prescription drugs to seniors is absurd. They're not, you know, there are some people who need help with their prescription drugs, but in 2000, both Al Gore and George Bush ran on the idea that our seniors were having to choose between food and pills. And Al Gore, during that campaign, actually tried to wring tears out of people by saying his mother, you know, and this is Al Gore, who was like a millionaire from, the revenue stream from his book about how global warming was going to destroy the planet Earth. He was saying that his mother had to choose between buying prescription drugs and food, which was an outright lie. And if anything, it was just a reflection on what a horrible son he is. But seniors don't spend very much money on prescription drugs already. But in that bill that expanded that, which up until before Obamacare was the biggest expansion of a Great Society entitlement program up until that point, Bush increased the idea, the caps for health savings account and medical savings account, which also under Obama, in a weird way, pushing the idea of high deductible, lower premium insurance plans. He's actually, that's the outcome of that might be to create more of a free market in a lot of day-to-day care because people are spending their own dollars or they're trying to spend as little as possible because it's really kind of coming out of pocket. So that's kind of an interesting irony of, I think of Obamacare as well as the Bush-era expansion of Medicare.
Sometimes I fantasize about what a private market in pediatric care would look like. I have two kids, a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, and the process of getting them their absolute basic, you know, get a couple of immunizations, have somebody like tap on their noggin to make sure they got a brain in there, which way is the E facing on the eye chart, like that should very, very clearly be something that I can get done in like a van that pulls up to my house that I summon with an app.
You'll do it. Yeah, it's fine.
Thanks,
Eden.
Thank you. I appreciate that. First of all, oh, sweet baby Jesus, no. But, you know, if you were part of the like Uber for immunizations and I could see that you had a good rating, sure. And there's no reason why that thing couldn't exist except, you know, as Peter points out, and as we've been talking about here, the world in which healthcare is even moderately disentangled from the state is almost impossible for us to imagine.
So we've got Nick pushing for greater supply and deregulation to accomplish that. We've got Catherine pushing for the Uberization of healthcare. Peter, is there anything that you would add to that in terms of a wish list for healthcare reform that we could seek?
The big thing that I would like to see is at least one party, if not both, push to equalize the treatment of health insurance between the individual market and employer and the employer market, and really between the employer market and everywhere. So the sort of original sin of the United States healthcare system is the carve out for employer sponsored insurance. And that has just wreaked havoc in the market. And then you add Medicare and Medicaid on top of that, two different government-run systems. Medicare, our only single-payer system, in the United States, And so you just have this incredibly fragmented and, you know, a sort of multi-part system in which everyone is subsidized different ways. And I understand sort of the libertarian objection that the ESI, it's a tax carve out. It's not really a subsidy, but in terms of the distortion on the market, it acts exactly as one. And so if we're going to provide a targeted tax carve out for people who get their insurance one way, then we ought to be, you know, we ought to treat people the same throughout their lives. And that what health insurance ought to be about doing is two things. One is, health policy should be designed around the idea that health insurance is primarily a financial product, not healthcare. And two, it is that it should be designed and targeted to help the poorest and sickest people the most. And right now we have a system that just doesn't do that at all and isn't conceived in that way at all.
God, you libertarian monster. You want to help the poor and the sick and treat people equally and fairly, regardless of their employment status? Jeez Louise. I mean, that's the thing, right? Is there's this idea that, you know, the motivations behind different proposals are different, and everyone's motivations are the same on one level. You know, it's crazy that we aggressively subsidize health insurance for people who are very well off, who could buy basic health products on their own. The disagreement about how to get there is so demonized in these discussions, which, you know, gets us back to this idea that Donald Trump just wants to let children with cancer die on the side of the road.
Well, we can all agree that Peter Suderman is a libertarian monster. But yeah, he brings up a good point. You've brought this up a couple times, Peter, that you regret that there is not a active political body pushing to deregulate our healthcare system, that it's sort of rapid expansion versus sluggish expansion. But a new study, or at least a new paper, came out from Cato from Emily Eakins saying that the population of libertarians is actually fairly significant in the United States. She has it at 10 to 20%, or it may range from 7 to 22%, depending on how you do it. And if you go through the paper, she goes through the analysis of, if you ask people, are you libertarian, it tends to be a lower amount. But when you start describing, you know, things that are socially liberal, socially tolerant, and also fiscally conservative, it tends to be a significant chunk of the population. Nick, do you think that this is accurate? And if so, why is there such a small amount of self-described libertarians out there?
Well, there's a couple of things. And one is that Emily Eakins, who used to be the polling director at Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes this podcast and everything we do, she's responding to a thing from the Voter Study Group, which is online by a guy named Lee Drutman, one of her, I think it was one of her advisors at UCLA where she got her PhD. But he recently came out with a study claiming that there were only about 3.8% of voters in 2016 could be classified as libertarian. The rest were liberal, conservative, or populist. And I think she's closer to the mark. She pointed out in a conversation that I had with her that the Drutman results are very much of an outlier. That most studies on this matter classify between 10 to 20% of the population as libertarian, which means broadly speaking that they're socially liberal and they are fiscally conservative. You know, that they tend to be pretty pluralistic when it comes to cultural issues and social issues, live and let live, and that they want a government that does less or spends money more wisely. So I think she's right. The question about the self-description of libertarians is kind of interesting, because I know a lot of people in the broad-based libertarian movement. And I would say I started at Reason in 1993, which I would say is like I had been reading the magazine and I, you know, knew about libertarians before that. But that would be kind of my initiation into this ragtag band of monstrous people who want to leave people alone more and help, you know, and create institutions that actually help people in need. I think that I think libertarian as a describer, as a descriptor, particularly as an adjective, is on the rise, because I think people are recognizing more and more that liberal and conservative are played out, that they have been used, and liberal or progressive, obviously, very few people, I think, relatively speaking, to describe themselves as liberal anymore. If you're really kind of liberal, you call yourself a progressive. But, you know, the Republicans and Democrats are kind of markers for conservative and liberal positions. They've had a tremendous run. And in the 21st century alone, we ping-ponged back and forth between liberal and conservative, Republican and Democratic administrations, Congresses, et cetera, and nothing is working. And for that reason, I think I've met more and more people who will use libertarian as an adjective. I'm a libertarian Democrat. I'm a libertarian conservative. And I think people are moving towards the idea of more choice and more freedom in everyday life. So that's my kind of two cents.
Catherine, historically, or at least the last 20 or 30 years, people tend to view libertarians as part of a broader right-wing coalition. There's, at least within elected officials, they tend to be, or outspoken libertarians tend to be Republicans. I think with Trump coming into office, and perhaps before that, there are more fractures between old classical liberal school of thought versus conservative thought. Do you think it's a good placement for self-identifying libertarians or merely libertarian-esque party members to retain that right-wing coalition?
So I have historically identified myself as a right-wing libertarian when pressed, although, of course, I prefer to be my own wing, as everyone does. But I think the historical, you know, the sort of Cold War historical alliance between libertarians and conservatives, which was basically the, communism sucks alliance, you know, it's still there. It's still embedded in the DNA of American politics. Certainly, it is true that there is in the actual U.S. Congress, if there is anyone who libertarians would see as the closest thing to a champion in the Congress, those people are overwhelmingly Republican identified. So while Republicans aren't the same thing as conservatives, I do think there's something just practical to be said there. At the same time, I find that when I use what I used to use as the capsule description of libertarian to say, socially liberal and fiscally conservative, no one knows what that means anymore. Those ideas are getting lost. When people hear socially liberal, I find that people now think I mean supports the welfare state as socially liberal. And when I say fiscally conservative, people still sort of mostly know that means sort of less. They know it means evil. They know it means less government spending, but they sometimes think it means just tax cuts and not actually reduced spending. So, I think the use of that notion of libertarians as a kind of half-see, borrows from both is falling apart. And I've started using variants about, maximizing choice, leaving people alone. I say, we basically want gay married couples to be able to defend their marijuana crop with guns, that kind of thing, which seems to have more resonance. And that's its own thing, right? When you say that phrase, you really aren't identifying with the right any more than you're identifying with the left. So I think the increase in sort of belief that entitlements can never and will never be cut on both sides complicates the placement where libertarians sit if you consider left-right, which is why this Eakins data and all of the other people who have looked at similar questions now use this two-part axis where they look at, authoritarian communitarian or some other dimension in order to understand where libertarians sit.
Is there a actual philosophical peg for people that are communitarian or populist? And in Eakins' paper, she talks about, I think she uses the phrase communitarian more than populist. I don't really feel like I know anybody that ever describes themselves as such. I know a lot of people here in New York that voted for Bernie Sanders who say generally incorrectly that they're socialists. And I would describe them as left-wing populists. But I don't know very many people that just say I'm a populist or I'm a communitarian. Is that an actual philosophical school of thought that should be taken into account?
I don't know if it's a philosophical school of thought in the academic sense. Oh, no, it is. I mean, but I think what the Eakins work and what some of the recent social science on kind of voter demographics is pointing out is that there's a reasonably large group of basically people who are anti-libertarians, people who want a lot more regulation and government spending and are also fairly socially conservative at the same time, and that those folks represent a non-trivial portion of the voter pool, and they tend to get left out of kind of traditional polar party thinking. I think that one of the things that we see in Eakins's response to Drutman here, but also in the Drutman work and just sort of developing in social science research about how people align politically, is that the Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal spectrum just does not do a great job of capturing how people actually are in terms of how people are aligned politically and what their political beliefs are. And this is an insight that libertarians have had for a very long time, as folks who are not well captured either by traditional conservative or traditional liberal political ideologies.
Which is also the group of people that were like, oh, hey, we didn't see y'all coming there until you voted for Trump, right? I mean, the way of thinking about this is the reason that people who think about political identities and ideologies were blindsided by Trump's election, at least in part.
I agree with you. I think the labels are fairly clumsy when they're in use. I find that a lot of the time when I do kind of comedic punditry here in New York periodically. And
God help us all.
Yes.
There is only comedic punditry.
That's you repeat yourself, my friend.
That's true. I'm not quite funny enough to be just sheer funny. So I do the political side of it. But a lot of the time, the understanding of libertarian even now is, okay, so you really like woodworking and you own a lot of guns. And they basically describe Ron Swanson, who I like and I think is a fun character, but there's a sort of lack of...
And who does claim to be a libertarian.
Now.
Right? He's not he's not just sort of somebody who people have described as libertarian. He claims that label for himself, which is important.
Well, but you know, this is also great because the actor who plays him is not a libertarian, and I suspect in another 20 years he'll become one because it'll be easier than constantly denying that he's a libertarian. And Ron Swanson was one of the breakout stars from that show, and it was really, you know, one of the things that he spoke to. I mean, it's very funny, and every libertarian I know finds him both hilarious because it's a pitch perfect parody on a certain level, but it's also getting the ideas out there. And I think, you know, this is where, and obviously Matt Welch and I have written about this, and we whip this horse across, you know, to the glue factory every chance we get. But as Peter and Catherine were both saying, the liberal conservative dichotomy or axis just does not really explain very much anymore. And the idea that you have to pick between a party, you know, if you're in the Democratic Party, you have to be pro-abortion, and you also have to be in favor of increasing the minimum wage, right? The national minimum wage. And these are two issues that do not, you know, they're not on the same equation for many, many Americans. They're just very separate. And on the Republican, you know, party side, you've got to be in favor of flag burning amendments and reducing the top marginal income tax rates. You know, these are things that may have at some point made sense as a political coalition. It just doesn't describe much of what's going on anymore. And I think people are looking for something different, and that something different is libertarianism. And Catherine, I like the way that you talk about it. In terms of it's neither right nor left. It is completely a different beast, which is also one of the reasons that for the first time over the past couple of years, in my experience at Reason and in the libertarian kind of world, more and more people are defining themselves as left libertarian. And I have a lot of problems. I'm not sure exactly what that means. But it's interesting that people are going into that direction as well, because I think people on the right and the left are kind of, we're using these terms that just don't really describe many people anymore.
So if I start describing myself as a left-leaning libertarian, will I be invited to more cocktail parties here on the East Coast? Is that how that works?
That's what our commenters believe.
Nice.
But unfortunately, because it's a libertarian cocktail party, it's always a cash bar.
Okay. But there'll probably be some interesting stuff to drink. Well, Nick, a moment ago, you brought up, I brought up Ron Swanson. You talked about the cultural contribution of Ron Swanson. In the world of culture, today is the 20th anniversary of Harry Potter, which has become a gigantic enterprise in and of itself. I think about 8 years ago, they determined that J.K. Rowling has more money than the Queen of England. So she's doing very well. And the ripple coming out from that has extended beyond Scotland and England, all throughout the United States. I think you've got kids, Nick, and Catherine, you've got kids. Nick, did you read Harry Potter to your kids growing up? Were they young enough for that?
Yeah, and I want to point out that I am Team Hufflepuff. I don't think that school gets enough credit in the Harry Potter series. But yeah, my older son, who is 23, came of age with Harry Potter, as well as also Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events, and a couple of other great series for kid and young adult series. But one of the signal events of my parenting was, I guess it was around 2000, and I think it might have been The Goblet of Fire was coming out, but in the town of Oxford, Ohio, where we were living, there was a book party when this book came out, which was like 600 pages long, at midnight, 12:01 on the day that it was being released. They opened the bookstore in town, and there were like 200 kids or 150 kids there with their parents in the middle of the night to buy a massively long book. And I was like, this is so fucking great. And Harry Potter, I think, is just a fantastic kind of transatlantic global phenomenon that it really excited kids as well as their parents. The movies are great. And it what I love about the series, actually, is that it's a, a testament to the idea of like finding your way in the world, and it's simultaneously individualistic as well as community based. I think it's been a phenomenal way to explore shifting identity and outsider insider issues in the 21st century.
Catherine, have you reared your children on a solid Harry Potter diet?
They're a little bit too small, and also they're kind of pussies. Like they don't like scary things in books. So we're gonna have to hold off a little bit. But I read you know some of the later ones as they were coming out, and absolutely shared that experience of walking around the streets of a major urban area after one of these books came out, and people are like hanging from scaffolding, like reading the books and like tucked into corners, and like hobos are reading them. Like, it was like a pretty touching moment for literacy. But I also like the idea that the Ministry of Magic is like a little bit of a joke in these books. You know, if you're going to do like the libertarian lessons of Harry Potter, which you probably shouldn't, but let's go ahead. And, the idea that there's a bunch of goobers who don't really understand the things that they're dealing with, and that who have kind of corruption from within that they don't see. I love that quite a lot. I'm not like a full Harry Potter nerd, but Stephanie Slade, my beloved managing editor, assures me that I am Ravenclaw. So I don't know what that means, but
by the way, the place to be, of course, is Slytherin.
Well, that's the devil gets all the best lines.
So can I ask, because I'm not that familiar with Harry Potter, and I missed out, and I wish I got into it. It seems to be a fun thing that everybody really enjoys, but it came out.
You were too busy with Star Trek, weren't you?
I was too busy with Star Trek and all these other nerdy things, and I guess when it came out, it came out 20 years ago, I kind of missed the boat on it, and I now feel that it's too late for me to get in where it's this experience that I grew up with, and I do not have children for a variety of reasons, but hopefully someday we'll sire some. I don't know all of the distinctions you're talking about. Slytherin is what, the evil house that has money? Is that why we want to be in it?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, not necessarily money, but
blood.
Because
good blood.
Most of the people there.
Pure blood.
Yeah,
that's my friend.
Right. Which is one of the themes of Harry Potter, right? It does have this kind of underlying theme of class prejudice and snobbery.
Yeah,
it's
we're definitely
British in that sense. I mean, it really kind of draws from the British schooling system and the British class thinking, as well as British thinking about the bureaucracy.
It's an echo of, the old boring books that nobody reads anymore, like Tom Brown's School Days and whatnot. And so it's a revision of that in a really interesting way, because You know, there are mudbloods, which are mixed bloods, half magician and half regular human. Muggles are regular humans; they're the worst. And then there's the full bloods. But it plays with that, and it has an international flair. There's an international wizards tournament and whatnot, and I think it's a really great updating. Michael Moses, who has written for us, who's a Duke University English professor, wrote a great essay about kind of how Harry Potter was being updated from earlier iterations of kind of English school literature back in 2003. And it's a very positive image of or vision of an inclusive kind of fluid class system. And then it does have, you know, the various commentaries on it. The one thing that I would say that's really hard for libertarians to deal with is that J.K. Rowling famously started writing this when she was on the dole as a single mother. And so along with rock and roll, which was heavily subsidized both by public schools in the U.S., basically making kids hate their lives and want to rebel. In England, a lot of people took dole money or money for school and bought instruments with it and created, you know, kind of modern pop music from that. Rowling, you know, is probably the best investment that the dole ever made in England.
I used to live in Edinburgh, which is where she wrote most of Harry Potter. And there are a couple of places where you can look out and you can see Edinburgh Castle and George Watkins. I can't remember the name of the school. That's kind of the vague basis for it. But there's one cafe in Edinburgh that has a sign that says J.K. Rowling never wrote here. Because every other cafe in Edinburgh claims that she wrote the entire book while sitting in their cafe.
She's the George Washington slept here of,
yes, exactly.
Of Edinburgh. Yeah.
Peter, go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to say, it's kind of amazing that, you know, so I haven't read the books. I've seen all the movies. I've sort of paid attention to the phenomenon without having been a super fan of the novels themselves. One of the things that consistently strikes me as amazing about Harry Potter and that world is just the incredible amount of value that this, in some ways, sort of silly child's, you know, story ended up creating. There are estimates, you know, that the franchise as a whole is now worth $25 billion. And this is after the main series has ended. And now they've gone on to the Fantastic Beasts series, which is sort of a follow up of some sort. But, you know, they've also built theme park worlds. Rowling herself has made something like has become a billionaire off of these, off selling the books, is my understanding. Although she at one point did deny being a billionaire. I think that was more than a decade ago, though. And just, you know, it's sort of a great illustration of sort of this fanciful children's story, this this kind of fantasy idea set down on paper and then executed well brought out to people has become such an incredible kind of economic engine and has brought so much value to the lives of so many people and has touched people, but has also become, you know, has made people's fortunes at the same time. I think it's really kind of a fascinating case study in how intangible things can turn into tangible economic value in ways that we don't always think about.
I'll add to that I think one of the benefits that you can point out to left-leaning or at least not particularly economically literate people is that J.K. Rowling became very, very wealthy without impoverishing anyone else. And I find that when I'm talking to people about rich people, it kind of hinges on who the rich person is. Everybody likes Richard Branson and Warren Buffett because the one is hot and the other one's cute. I've got a whole theory on this.
Can we strike that from the finished version of the podcast? And Catherine, I think you and I each have one comment at least that should be deleted.
I stand by every word.
Warren Buffett's an attractive man. I said it. Yeah, there.
But Warren Buffett is the most attractive man in the world.
Exactly. Yes, I'll stand by. I'm a left-leaning cocktail libertarian who's physically attracted to Warren Buffett. If he's listening, I'll come over. But I think
you are Slytherin. It turns out.
Yeah. I'm definitely yes.
I think that might be Hufflepuff.
I'm the nice guy in Slytherin that keeps explaining how nice I am to everybody and why they should be friends with me. But I think Rowling's a good example. example of making a tremendous amount of money without hurting anybody in the process. And in fact, you, because wealth itself is not a fixed amount, we're not living in a pie that forever is just being divided and redivided. You can do very well and add value.
By the way, you can get an ever increasing pie, I believe, in a bake shop on Diagon Alley.
That's true. Yeah, you wash it down with the butterbeer. It works very nicely.
Nick, to me, I look at this and I think that there's a fair amount of escapism built into Harry Potter. I'm somewhat familiar with it. I'm versed in it. That it seems that people are kind of bored with the bourgeois life that we live. That we're middle class. We've largely killed religion. We don't have nymphs. We don't really have angels anymore. So I see Harry Potter as kind of catering to that absence that's now in the modern life. Do you think that it's indicative of that escapist impulse?
That, you know, that's an interesting way to think about it, because it definitely has those fantastical elements. And I think those are really on display in the first movie, which is probably the least, maybe the second movie, are the least interesting movies in the series, because they're kind of flat representations of the book, of the books. But a lot of it, what the fun is just seeing like the magic being done and, you know, the idea of letters that come and yell at you and then disappear in a kind of crisp of fire and stuff like that. But actually, like all great, or maybe not all great, but much great children's literature, there is a certain element of fantasy, but this is a world that is filled with anxiety and fear and, you know, showdowns, not just with a bully around the corner, but a guy who is able to take over the entire universe, who has killed your parents. As Harry gets older and as the other main characters get older, they shift into adolescence. And I think, and somebody might be able to help me, I'm losing the chronology of the books a bit, but it might be The Half-Blood Prince or one of the later books, though, when one of the main characters gets killed and Harry realizes that he's alone in the world. And it's riveting, you know, just fantastic emotional peak in the books where the way that a lot of the classic Disney movies start with a moment of, you know, absolute horror, whether it's Finding Nemo or Bambi or even Dumbo, where, you know, there's the mother being ripped away from a child or parents being ripped away. There's a lot like that in Harry Potter. And I think one of the reasons why it appealed to so many people is that it does a good line of going back and forth between a kind of child's delight as well as that horror and fear and understanding that you have to grow up and face a destiny, one that you create yourself.
She also wrote these books. I mean, it was the end of history when she first started writing these books, right? I mean, she's writing them in the 90s, particularly I think she finished the first book in 1995, probably published in 1999 or 98. And, you know, the idea that that we were sort of maybe a little more allowed to be frivolous, or that, you know, the sort of, we had to look for big stakes in a magical world because our own world, maybe we were done fighting global universal battles.
Yeah, we won.
We won. And the history was over and it was awesome.
Russia's our friend now. They admitted their fault.
And by the end of the series, of course, the real world looks very different and the world of the books is much darker. So I think there's something to be said for these books as a bridge from the end of history into wherever we are now, the 21st century's variant of resuming history.
Catherine, is there a motivating ideology behind Voldemort? I ask, like, is he, I don't know, is he trying to accumulate money? Is it about power? Is he just vindictive?
He's racist, right? He doesn't like the mudbloods. He likes the pure blood of the wizarding families.
Oh, really?
To rise again. Yeah. So fuck that guy.
So he's basically sort of like a Magneto, like magic versus non-magic type guy.
It's somewhere. He's Magneto Hitler. Yeah, basically.
Magneto Hitler. Okay, great.
With no nose.
Well, before we...
No, but noses, come on. We've evolved past the noses. We have all have our personal smellers. We have Shazam for smells on our cell phones now, don't we?
Oh, my God. Please. Please, no.
Well, so we've got 20 years of J.K. Rowling. I assume that we'll have another 20 years, or if not 200 of her novels. We're perhaps closing on the reign of Anthony Kennedy in the Supreme Court, who is indicating that he might in fact be mortal and might retire and is putting out certain feelers there. If that happens, Peter, are you happy about Trump replacing him? I'm not physically replacing him, but replacing his successor.
I think Donald Trump would make the greatest, classiest Supreme Court justice. Neil Gorsuch is a pick who, you know, regardless of whatever else you think of how Trump has behaved as president, basically every conservative and libertarian vouched for Gorsuch and is pleased with him. And if Trump makes another pick along those lines, then that is something that then I think that will be a real and positive legacy in the court. That said, I think that the politics around an Anthony Kennedy replacement get real dicey real fast. They get very heated, I suppose I should say, because Kennedy, while he was a Republican appointee and is often votes with the conservative bloc, is the swing justice and is sort of the person who has kept this 9-member court in some sense balanced between the liberal and conservative wings. And if Trump replaces him with someone who is just a down the line conservative voter or much more of a conservative voter, then I think that Democrats, that liberal activists it will really kind of shake up the national political scene in ways that are in some ways difficult to predict perfectly, but it's going to add a lot of fire, a lot of energy to the upcoming elections in 2018 and 2020.
That is really an exciting proposition, Peter, because I believe it was a guy named Barack Obama who, after winning elections, said elections have consequences, deal with it. You know, we won, deal with it. I'm not a big believer that the Supreme Court is the leading edge of anything, that it, I think it certifies social consensus and political consensus more than drives it forward or pulls it backwards. And that's both fortunate and unfortunate. The fact is that the Republicans have won a series of elections that give them absolutely Donald Trump every right to do it. I suspect that he will, if Kennedy steps down while Trump is president, that he will appoint somebody who has impeccable academic credentials that people might hate. And I think that would be good for the country, just to have that kind of live tutorial of what goes into, serious legal, kind of scholarship. And what are the limits of that? Because this is it's checks and balances. And if the Republicans have won consistently enough elections and have maintained control of the House and Senate, they get more say in what goes on. So, bring it on. I think that'll be good for the country.
There's also a weird thought process for most Americans that there are conservative and liberal justices in the sense that they are openly advocating for the political positions of the party that put them in. And the judicial landscape, at least theoretically, tends to be between originalism and the idea that you're literally interpreting the law as it was written at the time, or living constitutionalism. But I find that when I'm firmly in the originalist camp, and I was happy with Gorsuch, and I'm not happy with Trump as a president overall, I'm very pleased with what he's doing judicially, and don't think it would be the end of the world if he did that. Catherine, one of our colleagues, Damon Root, his is kind of pioneering a libertarian school of judicial thought. From my vantage point, he's sort of positing libertarian judicial activism. So I politely disagree with him. But is that something that you're more invested in, that you think's a good way to go? Do you think that should be a new school of judicial thought?
I think he is tapping into an existing but under-articulated school of judicial thought. And yes, I am a staunch member of Team Root on this. And I think, I think one place that you see a variant of this playing out is with Kennedy. He's a Reagan appointee who is the deciding vote to clear the way for same-sex marriage. And the way that that happens is if you stop thinking about originalism versus living constitution or any of these other things, and you think about judges as essentially people trying to, within the rules of the system, get good outcomes, get just morally just, morally good, politically powerfully good outcomes, and this is a place where, but I will still say Kennedy's Kennedy's language in that decision, in the Obergefell decision. He says of gay couples, they ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law, and the Constitution grants them that right. So still the judges sort of, you know, drape the Constitution around their shoulders and run around in circles. But you know, I also think Kennedy is a case study in, you really don't know what you get when a Republican appoints a justice. It doesn't mean he's going to be a conservative down the line. It really, really doesn't. I mean, you know, no one would have said Reagan's appointing the guy who's going to legalize gay marriage. I will predict right now, though, that for all of us were very impressed with the Gorsuch pick and the general optimism, particularly in the kind of Federalist Society crew about Trump's picks, I think he's going to pick somebody totally, totally crazy balls.
Gary Busey.
I think it's going to be Ivanka for Supreme Court justice or something. I think he has held it together on this, and there are a lot of people putting a lot of pressure on him to get another Gorsuch. A, I'm not sure there is another Gorsuch. B, I'm not sure Gorsuch could have gotten approved for Kennedy's spot. And C, it's Trump. So there's just always a wild card. So my prediction now is he's going to pick somebody totally out of left field. His advisors are not going to know the pick is coming. And the whole world is going to lose its mind.
I think that is distinctly possible, and that in particular, the political environment where Trump is anxious and upset with how he's being treated, with some of the Russia investigations, et cetera, may contribute to Trump making an out of left field pick.
Maybe he'll appoint Robert Mueller to the Supreme Court.
There you go. I'm firing the guy, but I'm making him a Supreme Court justice.
I would watch that episode
of The West Wing.
I'll take issue a bit with the idea of originalism as like a fulcrum in what libertarians want, and to a certain degree what Damon is talking about, although Damon Root has talked for himself in his recent book about the Supreme Court. But there's also an older split between people who believed in kind of majoritarianism and the Constitution, you know, where and this was somebody like Robert Bork, who was also a Reagan appointee who didn't make it. But Bork essentially believed in procedural due process, and that what the Constitution allowed was anything that a legislature that was duly elected, legally elected, whatever they decided in the name of whatever, could pass. And that, you know, he was actually coming off of mostly what is now associated with progressives and liberals, that, you know, the majority can do whatever it wants, basically, with very broad parameters, versus people who were into what is normally called procedure or substantive due process, where it's saying, no, the Constitution actually limits the size and scope of government in regulating people's lives and economic lives and all types of activity. And that's actually the libertarian activism, judicial activism, is really in the name of saying, no, you know, this is effectively the Constitution is a classically liberal libertarian document that is all about restricting the ability of the government to boss individuals around. And, you know, that where you see that in one of its fullest forms, or, you know, a shriveled flower, really, is in the Raich case, which was about medical marijuana law in California. Antonin Scalia, you know, there is no way that if you believe in federalism and originalism and all of this kind of stuff, like, of course you would say that a state has a right to dictate medical marijuana policy that for marijuana that does not enter into interstate commerce it's totally contained within the state. Scalia, if he was truly serious, he would have voted in favor of Raich, but he did not, because he's results oriented. And I think that's one of the things that we need to come to terms with, is that all justices are, in fact, results oriented. It's very rare when they actually are working out a legal philosophy that is consistent and universally applied. And one of the things that's very interesting is that Clarence Thomas, who when he came into the Supreme Court, he was widely perceived and derided by liberal and progressive analysts as an affirmative action pick, that he wasn't up to the level of scholarship that most Supreme Court justices had, et cetera. A guy like Mark Tushnet, who is an emeritus professor at Georgetown Law, who disagrees with Clarence Thomas, but he said, and he wrote a great book called A Court Divided about a decade ago, talking about how Clarence Thomas is really the only serious justice who is actually trying to create and apply and grow a system of law. And Thomas has his problems, but he's generally in that camp of trying to limit the size and power of government. And I think that's, you know, that's worth thinking about from a libertarian perspective. Although I agree, I guess, with Catherine and Peter that Trump could go wild with the next pick. But I actually think he'll play it safe in that camp because there's not that much of a I don't think there's that much of an upside for, appointing or trying to appoint his sister, who's a judge, something like that.
I was surprised at the Gorsuch pick. I really thought he was going to do Gary Busey or something weird like that. Trump being feckless and having no actual ideology, I saw no reason he would veer in any particular direction. Well, Catherine and Nick, you've more or less talked me into reading Damon's book so that I can better articulate my own staunch originalist position next time I argue with you guys. But on a happier note, if you were able to select the successor for Kennedy, who would you pick? I think I'd go with Judge Napolitano. I think he'd be a great addition to the court, and I would love that. Catherine?
I'm going to go Randy Barnett. Speaking of the Raich case, I love that guy. I think he's probably as close as anyone out there to, agreeing with what I'd like to see on the court philosophically. But he's exactly the kind of guy that I think it's wildly unlikely that Trump would pick, precisely because of his utter lack of populist appeal. Anybody that's like a head of the Lysander Spooner fan club has my vote, but probably not America's heart.
I am going to go with Judge Reinhold because I want to see a guy named Judge. I think Barnett and Napolitano would be great, and I'd throw in people like Don Willett, the Texas judge who has one of the liveliest Twitter feeds.
I follow him on Twitter, yeah.
Yeah, you know, certainly when you're reduced to, talking about people based on their Twitter feeds, the American experiment has ended.
Wrong. I want my future Supreme Court justice to communicate with me via meme, for sure. I'm not even kidding.
You want cats to have judicial decisions underneath them, Catherine?
Yes, ideally.
And Peter, do you have a pick?
I mean, I'm also for Willett and the gift decisions. does anybody like reading Supreme Court decisions?
First of all, you do, Peter, first of all, don't lie.
So that's true. I do. I'm entirely selfishly Willett because he's a funny and interesting writer.
Yes, I agree. It would be a pleasure to read those decisions.
I think Ginsburg might actually be doing a Weekend at Bernie's thing right now where she passed away a year ago. But in the event that she retires, I would add to that. I like Tim Sandifer quite a lot, who I think is a great writer and a great legal mind. So I'll add to that. Well, gang, as always, I am smarter for having spoken to you for the length of the podcast. You've been listening to The Reason Podcast, which you can get on iTunes. While you're there, please rank and review us and come back again for more sex, drugs, robots, and freedom.